Hey everyone, welcome to another session of Office Hours with Cloud Posse. This is where we discuss the latest DevOps news, AWS announcements, Terraform insights, stuff like that, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus the live Q&A. You can't find it anywhere else. It's July 16th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse sells AWS reference architectures backed by Terraform, so you can get production ready in about 2 weeks. So if you're curious, check it out. Go to cloudposse.com and learn more. How can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, the format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like and ask questions. And if you're curious of any of about any of our open source tools, like Atmos, this is a great place to ask. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. You can join us by registering at cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. We'll send you an invite so you can join these calls live via Zoom and ask any questions you have. So I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, just share it with your team. You'll find it at youtube.com/cloudposse. It'll be posted there in a few hours. So with that said, let's see what caught my attention this past week. All right. First one, I think Michael, you also shared it in the Zoom chat. I saw Matt talking about it in LinkedIn. Is that Amazon has jumped on the bandwagon, introducing their own agentic IDE. I haven't taken a closer look at it. I would assume it's based on VS Code like Windsurf and Claude, or I mean Cursor, and built on code, so you can keep your VS Code setting. Yeah, exactly. So they've done the same thing. It's like VS Code has become the Chrome engine for browsers. Every IDE now being built is basically Chrome under the hood, and then different skin slapped on top. So this is Kiro. The ghost is not to be confused with Ghosty, Mitchell Hashimoto's terminal. This icon looks incredibly similar to Ghosty. But yeah, Kiro is they're trying to create a more vertically integrated IDE for AWS, so it's easier to build, launch, and deploy your apps all within AWS using a modern IDE based on VS Code. I think this actually explains why Amazon just went freaking nuts with MCPs. So 17 hours ago, they dropped all of these MCPs for all kinds of things. And not just like Amazon services, like Memcache, Prometheus, generic things like what was the Postgres as well was in here. And obviously, a whole slew of MCPs specifically for AWS services. What drew my attention to this particular announcement was that they announced another MCP specifically for AWS APIs. So this is pretty interesting and pretty exciting. Obviously, I don't think this is something you couldn't accomplish in a similar way with Cursor or with Windsurf. But Amazon doing this, let's face it, this was the missing piece for them to complete what they have, this incredibly complex cloud platform. And yet, I don't know. Because Amazon has started sunsetting more products, it also makes me a little bit worried about it as well. I'm guessing, is some of those products were less popular. Cloud9, they sunset. AWS Code Commit, they sunset. They have other things in this category of like the IDE that they've sunset. And I guess in 2020 hindsight, maybe it makes a lot more sense now. If they've been working on Kiro this whole time, now it makes more sense why they're focusing the efforts on this solution. But it does suck if you had previously thought they had the solution and you were using their like Cloud9 IDE. Any thoughts on Kiro or what's going on inside of AWS here?
Yeah, I had a couple thoughts. The first one was they made a comment in one of the announcements that this was an editor that was built from the ground up with agentic editing in mind. But I'm like, wait a minute, it's a VS Code clone. How can you be built from the ground up, number one? And then number two, built from the ground up with agentic development in mind. So yeah, they're blowing smoke with that particular statement. But kind of along the lines of what you mentioned, I do feel like it's a walled garden for development on Amazon using agents and MCPs, but the doors to the garden are open, right? Everything's kind of open source, the platform's open source, VS Code, et cetera, et cetera. So they are vertically integrating everything, but it's still kind of open so you can see inside before you step in. And I think it might be kind of cool to develop AWS stuff on a fully integrated AWS platform. So I haven't tried it yet, but I am very curious.
I mean, if AWS could pull this off successfully, they could basically be like, or I mean, I guess this is not the right way. Well, what Next.js has done to React at, combined with Vercel has made it an incredibly pleasant development experience. It, done well. AWS together with like CDK and what are they calling this, Kiro, and all the capabilities they have there, they could maybe actually pull this off as a mature, robust, developer-friendly ecosystem for development. But
Yeah, last comment I would say kind of along those lines. Imagine, like, I always look at the Amplify service and how Amplify is kind of competing with services like Heroku and Firebase and some other ones. But imagine if you could go into this editor and say, I mean, just put in your, maybe log in with your AWS account or whatever, and you say, hey, make me this thing, app X, whatever app X is, and you can have your prompt be as elaborate or not elaborate as you want, but then you still get the CloudFormation, you get the code, you get maybe a deployment pipeline. Like everything's already laid out for you, and then you just start tweaking it to perfection or however you want your app to look. That would be pretty slick, in my opinion.
And drive tremendous spending.
Ah, true.
Oh my God. I dude, this is so interesting. All these events going on now, and you can see that these aren't coincidences now, together with this announcement of Kiro. Because what's the other drama that's been going on in the past week? Which is, well, I think last week or the week before, we talked about Windsurf getting acquired by OpenAI, and we talked about like, that's kind of weird that OpenAI is buying Windsurf, given that Microsoft is one of their biggest investors and they have VS Code. And like, why aren't they like getting closer with VS Code and Microsoft or things like that? And well, it turns out that was a deal breaker. And that's why OpenAI backed out of the deal to buy Windsurf, Windsurf being the other major agentic editor out there, formerly called Codeium, I think. So if you heard of that, that's what that was. And then what happened this week was that deal falls apart, and like faster than you can snap your fingers, the CEO of Windsurf is now moving over to Google. Google is now licensing Windsurf IP at like $2.4 billion or something. So less than the 3 billion from the OpenAI act, the proposed 3 billion from the OpenAI acquisition that fell apart. And then at the same time, Devon AI, which is AKA Cognition, swoops in and buys the rest of the IP and the Windsurf team, the remaining team at Windsurf. And this has got to be in response to kind of what Amazon is doing. So now Google is going to come out with their Windsurf like thing for Google Cloud, while Amazon has their Cairo, and well, and Microsoft obviously has Copilot. So that's what's going on, folks. Really interesting to watch this as a spectator. And how fast these things go. Like, I can't believe how quickly this deal falls apart, and immediately Google swoops in, takes CEO, team goes over here, and like it's like working like clockwork on the surface. Well, related to that, yeah. So then I thought this was kind of a funny announcement. I don't think they meant it to be funny, but like Amazon free tier now offers $200 in credits. What? So you can get like a couple API gate or a couple NAT gateways running in your VPCs for a month, and that expires after 6 months. So I really don't know what you can do in AWS for $200. And in this pissing competition then between AWS and Google, so Amazon just announced an astronomical number of nodes that it supports now under EKS, 100,000 nodes. Like I remember when it was a big deal that people were talking about 50,000 nodes, and I thought even 30,000 nodes was stretching it. So 100,000 worker node clusters are now supported under EKS. And why is that a pissing competition? Well, Google Cloud, they need to update this because they only support 65,000 nodes. So, you know, who are you going to go with? All right. Any comments on EKS node sizes?
And I'm reading that Azure only supports 5,000. I don't know if that's still correct. That stuff seems to be changing so fast. Like, I'm sure they're going to be doing something soon too.
Yeah, they're gonna have to if they want to stay relevant here. And just like, what a cash cow it is for these cloud providers. Like in their announcement, they're saying that this is really, you know, so that you can run, you know, AI ML training workloads in AWS. And yeah, and oh, this is just printing money for Amazon at this point. Good to meet you. All right, next. I thought this was an interesting one because of the precedent it sets, or at least maybe they've been doing this. I don't know. But this is the first one that gets my attention, so that's why I'm calling it the precedent. So Cloudflare, as you all know, sits in front of a astronomical number of the internet's traffic, right? They're fronting pretty much something like 60% or something of the world's traffic. And what does that mean? That means that they are now, so they're a target, therefore, for governments to use them to carry out their censorship rules. So obviously, you know, not supporting piracy and you know, let's face it, torrent sites are predominantly used for piracy. And so I don't feel sympathy in that sense, but I do find it scary in the precedent that it sets to be able to start blocking content. Obviously, the sites themselves can just unlist from Cloudflare, and now they're no longer blocked from that standpoint. But it is a pretty easy way for governments then to restrict that. Any thoughts on this one?
Pretty disappointing to say the least. I'm based in the UK, so this is pretty fresh news, but I just popped another link in the chat. Just yesterday or the day before, Reddit recently rolled out very similar things. So to visit any quote-unquote adult websites, you would have to verify your age. How do you verify your age? Your license, your government ID. And that is, it's a very easy thing to just yell. It's to protect children when there is no kind of what are we protecting them from? Who decides what is what? Isn't it up to the parents? Because what's adult for some persons could just be, hey, we can't teach homosexuality and things like that. And that's a little bit of a trickery, slippery slope.
Slope,
But yeah, I think it's part of a UK legislation that went live just 2 days ago, and a few different sites are going for it.
there any relationship to Cloudflare in Reddit doing this? Is Reddit using technology from Cloudflare, or they implemented
I
it?
don't think so. The only relation is that both Cloudflare and Reddit are doing it for the same reason. It's called the Online Safety Act of the UK.
Yeah.
And that's why they're having to forcefully do this.
And Rishabh, were you in the UK? I forget. Or
I am, yeah, I'm based in Scotland, so north.
okay, gotcha.
Pretty sad stuff. And it's one of those things where this isn't the first of its kind. Just a few years ago, 2016, the first thing that went up was all ISPs would have to default their mature filters or adult filters will be enabled by default. And it's one of those things where, okay, that's fine. It's up to the parents to toggle it. They can choose to enable it, disable it. But that's never enough. It's always adding more and more steps where, just like you started this off, it becomes very much like, aren't we just censoring things now from the government? Isn't that what this is turning into?
Censorship under a different name, which is kind of scary. I just, yeah, it hurts that we don't call it censorship. I'd feel a little bit less concerned if we just literally called it censorship, but saying no to censorship.
And for what it's worth, I think this isn't the first time. I'm almost certain I've heard, like in the US, like 20 states have gone through similar things, a whole
Texas is
bunch
one
more.
of them. Yeah.
Oh, is it right? Yeah. It's a tricky one because on the one hand, it is so, I've had so many kids or nephews and nieces that come through, and every time, how do you make, they're all online, they've got tablets in front of them from age 3 onwards. How do
Yeah.
you make sure they're fine? How do you make sure they're safe? It's harder to do that every day.
The brave new world. And arguably one of the most dangerous things they could talk to right now is ChatGPT too. That's not going to get blocked. All right. All right, let's see. So we've covered a lot of ground here. And then okay, so and then Cloudflare has an outage. So that was, you know, I guess that's newsworthy in the sense that they had an outage that was quite severe just a couple weeks ago that took out just this ton of sites. And I forget what the root cause on that one was. Well, there was another brief outage here on their DNS provider, which, you know, has become kind of foundational in the internet as a default DNS resolver for a lot of sites. What I did find really interesting, though, was the top post here on Hacker News, which was if you're using DNS Mask, though, you can query all servers at the same time and let the first one win. So that seemed like a pretty awesome thing to basically eliminate the impact of any future root server or DNS server outages like that. All right. Anyone know what the root cause was of the Cloudflare outage this past week?
I think I was just reading about it, and it was something to do with on July 2nd or so, they popped in a change which was erroneous, a configuration failure. And then on just a day or so ago, they brought up a new data center in a new region. And as part of bringing up a new data center, they have to sync their global tables. And as soon as they sync their global tables, that error then went live. All of their 1.1.1 was routed to the offline data center that they're bringing up.
All right. Yes.
That sucks. And there was also a weird one where apparently 1.1.0 is another thing that they control, but that was quote unquote hijacked by an Indian company, Tata Communications. But in
Really?
the report that they shared, the root cause analysis mentioned that's a bit of a side effect. That happened, yes, but it wasn't the cause of anything. They're still communicating with the company to figure out what happened there. Why did they hijack it?
Was this related to BGP, like
Yeah,
route?
that's exactly right. Yeah, it was the BGP Origin hijack.
Yeah, this is
And
scary.
it happened apparently within minutes, but so they assume it must have been just some automation that went wrong, but it is a bit curious how that happens.
Interesting. All right, let's see. We covered that. All right. The minor announcement just caught my attention. Linux for the desktop reaches 5% market share in the US. I think it's a little bit lower globally in the 4, 4.5 range. But it's nice to see Linux is still growing. It'll never replace, obviously, Windows or Mac OS. I'm curious, what is the penetration of Mac OS? I mean, apparently, relative to Windows, it's still relatively minuscule, no? Curious. What is the penetration of Mac OS? Just checking quickly here on ChatGPT, curious. Well, 28 to 30% is the estimate here. Obviously, could be wrong. Worldwide is around 10, 15 to 16%. Next, click to cancel. Yeah. And the last one, I was so hopeful. This was the best thing ever. I felt like they're finally looking out after the little guy. And I don't know anybody out there who's ever, had to lose their temper trying to get their service canceled. This was supposed to eliminate that. Like, they make it so easy to sign up for a service, and then you gotta like write a written notarized letter to send to your to Bally's gym if you want to cancel, when you could just sign up, in 5 minutes by walking in. So, this was supposed to go live just a few days ago, at least here in the US, and it was blocked on a technicality. And it's kind of ironic because the reason it was blocked is because any legislation that could impact the US economy at more than 100 million needs to go through a regulatory analysis. And yeah, exactly. And that's why we need this, because that's the amount of scams, if you will, leveraging this hard this thing where you cannot cancel. And an economy built on the consumer not being able to opt out on what they purchased is not a free economy. So I don't like that. Anyways, I'm hoping it'll eventually pass, but no time soon. All right. Any other news and announcements caught your attention this week? Rishav, anything else interesting?
I just noticed the other day that IAC Conf announced their new conference. So they're open for proposals for speakers, and the theme for this year is security in your infrastructure as code.
Got it. Is this this is led by Spacelift IAC Conf, or
It is, that's right. And I believe it has Matt Gowey there.
Matt is presenting, I believe, on one of them. So that's interesting. And this is a virtual conference, right?
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah, here at Matt Gowey.
Did anyone else have Matt Gowey pop up in their Instagram feeds yet?
No, has he started the Instagram?
Yeah, he showed up in mine. I sent him a screenshot. There's a Instagram ad with Matt Gowey and a couple others for a panel or some workshop, but I thought it was pretty awesome. So maybe if you folks are on Instagram, keep an eye out for it if you get targeted.
Yeah. Like and upvote.
Oftentimes, when these kind of organizations, they say they're platform agnostic, but it is good to see, I guess, things like Tofu being mentioned, and I'm assuming Ansible is there as well. So there is actually a pretty broad range. It's not just Terraform.
Yeah, well, and tofu, I mean, that's a legal imperative, right?
Right.
For a company like Spacelift, so yeah, and
Oh,
well,
that's right.
and Spacelift is a huge, backer of it. Like they've contributed, I don't know how many full-time engineers for OpenTofu. So OpenTofu is in large respect thanks to Spacelift. So that makes sense. All right. And Martine delivering the closing.
I joined a bit late. Did you already talk about the Windsurf editor being not bought by one, but bought by another?
Oh yeah. That was a fun one. Well, and then Amazon, announced Cairo, so it all comes together. So the picture is quite clear. Microsoft Azure, they have Copilot. Amazon now has Cairo, also based on VS Code as a fork, and then Google acquiring or Google acquiring, so to say, the CEO of Windsurf to now probably lead an agentic editor at Google because Google is trying to play catch up to now Microsoft and Amazon.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I gotta figure out if I'm gonna stick with Windsurf or find some new one now.
Well, let me know so if I have to cancel our team to reach out. But yeah, I've been still happy with Cursor at least. And
Of curiosity, how are you finding Windsurf compared to, say, just VS Code and GitHub Copilot?
let's see. So, to just VS Code and Copilot, I'd say I didn't give it a fair trial. I was a JetBrains user have been for the past, I don't know, 5, 10 years.
Gotcha.
And the hard part was there's all these agentic IDEs out there, and so I was trying to find one that kind of fits. And JetBrains has Juni, which is their plugin of that. Had Copilot, and that was kind of cool, that worked. But really what sold me on Windsurf was the tab completion, because all the agentic AIs can kind of do, hey, build me this app or whatever, or do this for me, and it gives you some good suggestions and some that are not so great. Copilot was pretty much in the same boat for me, but for Windsurf it was really, the key difference was really just tab complete. I'll have the agentic AI doing one thing, modifying some files, but sometimes you just got to dig into the code.
Another window, you're just hitting tab, tab, tab.
Exactly. It's pretty great because when I'm writing Terraform, it's like, all right, well, let's, update the count of all these modules, and of course, then I got to update all the references to them and stuff. And I just update the count, and then it knows tab, 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 and everything's done. And it's like, oh, well, that's a lot off my mental to-do list.
Oh, like adding the enabled flag, for
Yeah,
example.
if I added an enabled flag to a module, I then have to say, I want to do, if I'm pointing to like VPC private subnets or something, right? And we did a remote lookup of our VPC. Well, the private subnets, you then need to say module.vpc brackets, either asterisk and surround it in a one or something. And it's like, it's not hard. You just got to do it. And that's where the AI is really great. And the Windsurf is, the tab complete's been fantastic, but if that's going away, I don't know. For me, the hard part of switching to VS Code was really the look and feel of it, and of course all of the shortcuts. But to switch to Windsurf, I had to make that switch. And there's some plugins for JetBrains users, and then of course you just have to spend a couple days with it, constantly modifying your settings.
One thing, I've been using Junio in the past couple of weeks, and I'm really impressed. I guess that stuff changes, so quickly. So, yeah, like I give it say a script to write. I look at it overall, and then I say debug it, and I give it some instructions on how to do that. And it'll run the script. It'll ask me for confirmation sometimes. It'll make modifications as it's going through and finding trace backs, and then eventually it gives a solution. I have a look and continue from there. During that time, I can do other stuff, work on other tickets, and just look once in a while if it's prompting me for something or. That's pretty major.
This was that IntelliJ plugin.
Yeah, that's right. It's called Junio. Yeah. Once in a while, I do revert back to ChatGPT for that stuff or GitHub Copilot in JetBrains. It kind of depends on what I need. Like sometimes I find that if I'm more at the conceptual level and I'm, trying to figure out alternatives or get a deeper understanding of something that I'm not as familiar with, I'll go to ChatGPT and then I'll get the high-level concepts and the pros and cons and things like that, and then I'll, be able to give a better prompt to JetBrains Junio.
I agree with that. I do that too. That's actually interesting. So I have a question for everyone else here. Matt Calhoun, who's a regular often on the show, has been a big proponent of the warp terminal. And I don't know why it just didn't click for me why I would like it so much. And then I tried it out this past week, and I regret not having done it earlier. And how it clicked for me was, well, if I'm using Cursor and I really enjoy how it just fixes my, any issues I run into or any bugs I do or does the research for me, well, this is that on the command line. And that worked really well for me this week when, and what a success story was, like, I started it up. I have ASDF installed. ASDF, if you're not familiar, this is that thing that allows you to run multiple versions of software and switch between them. It's a bash framework for basically running different tools. And it's gone through some major updates lately and changed how it works. And I never got back to updating it, reading how to update it, or whatnot. So when I started Warp, the first thing I see is this error in ZSH relating to ASDF. Warp sees this, or okay. So then I ask Warp, "Hey, I guess you're not running ZSH, because then why am I getting all these errors?" And then it goes and investigates. It sees, what version I have installed. It literally curls the README of the ASDF project, looks at the setup instructions, sees how I have it misconfigured, tries to change it, fails at first, fails again, and then succeeds, and now it's all working, and I didn't have to do anything. And it was just magical seeing it work through that process in front of me, just like we see in Cursor or any of the agentic IDEs. Seeing this on the command line resolve my Z profile issue was pretty awesome.
I had one question about that. I mean, it sounds like an awesome experience. I'm in the same kind of boat because I'm really dialed into iTerm and the way that I use that, but I'm curious about agentic shells. I guess number one thing is the cost. So if you get into the pricing for it, like what do you get for free? When are you going to tap out as far as credits go? And me having to justify another 20 to $30 AI subscription because I've already got it for how many other apps. So yeah, I guess that's the main thing that I'm kind of wondering about. Oh, the other thing I was going to follow up with, if there is an option to point it to a local interface, like I'm running Ollama, it's got OpenAI interface or whatever. If I can say, hey, Warp or whoever else, because I know other tools support that. Like, yeah, I'll give you $5 to start, but when I run out of tokens, don't carpet me about upgrading. Just switch to this backup and just run my local agent just so I can get some stuff done, you know?
Yeah, and I can't claim to know Warp enough, since I'm a very newcomer to it. What I did want to say, though, well, okay, so yeah, does anybody know the answer to Michael's question? Can you point Warp at other language models?
Well, while we're on this page, while we're waiting for somebody to jump in, just click the pricing tab. I just want to see what they, I mean, I suppose I could do it in my browser as well, but you're sharing
Yeah.
screen, so.
So I haven't paid for it yet. I'm on the free tier right now, which gives you a certain number of tokens. It also indexes your code bases, which is cool because then it's more aware of kind of, well, if there's any documentation in there, what to run.
Yeah.
What constitutes an AI request? Like, is it one line at the one prompt, basically entry, or? Because you could run out. 150 is not a lot at a
Yeah,
terminal.
like if that were tokens, it would be like one question. No, I'm guessing that's an interactive request. And I think the real idea is run this long enough to validate that that is valuable for you or beneficial, and then upgrade to $15 a month. And Michael, I felt that way as well, especially in the beginning when, I felt what I was paying a lot already for, ChatGPT and OpenAI. And I was like, why do I need to pay somebody else for their AI system? And I guess what has changed things for me was just seeing how much more efficient I was paying that amount of money. So on principle, I agree that I'm already paying for equivalent functionality, LLM capability over here. But that's not the right measure. The measure is how much more productive am I? If I pay that $15 a month, can I say that it saved me 15, whatever the equivalent is in, in my annual income or whatever, for that amount of money? And hands down, obviously, right? It adds up pretty quickly, the savings that you get. Michael, your hand.
Yeah, I totally agree. And like for the tools that I pay for, Cursor being one of them, ChatGPT being another one. I also pay for Firefly's AI. I pay for Loom, which is a video recording software. It has AI features built into it for video editing. I get so much, what do I want to say, like productivity out of those tools, like a productivity boost out of those tools. I can totally justify paying 100, 150 bucks a month for my total AI spend, right? It's
That's right.
just like when you get to that point, it's like, well, how much more productivity am I going to get if I add another $15 to it? And maybe, it will kind of come together and the productivity will be there. But if I'm already dialed into iTerm, all of my stuff is configured to work there, and I can really kind of, jam with it, then I'm a little bit more hesitant to go to another tool because of the AI. And then thank you for opening the pricing screen. I'm looking at another thing that kind of gives me a little bit of pause. I appreciate the indexing, but my concern there would be code bases that don't want to be indexed. Like if you're working with a client, customer, or an enterprise or whatever that says,
It
yay,
prompts.
verily, you have to use our internal copilots or agents or whatever. And now here I come with this warp setup. It's like, oh, let me see your code base. I'll, VPN. Pull the code, and now all of a sudden the code is indexed with a third party that they don't know about. So it's like, well, crap, I didn't mean to, but it's a potential, or I guess I'll ask the question, is it a potential escape for the code indexing?
I don't know enough about it. That could be a case, but this brings up another good point that those, Michael, who's a regular here, Rosenfeld, he gave it a shot, and when he saw how many different how much telemetry they were gathering, it turned him off, so he stopped using it. So that is a concern, obviously, to investigate.
Huh, I did not
We
know
work on open source, like it's
that.
like big deal if it leaks. It's already public, right?
Yeah,
But
exactly.
totally
Open source, they
understand.
could have it. Yeah.
Exactly. But if it's private repos, I get it. And then, okay, there was one more thing I wanted to highlight here, but Ben, were you going to say
Yeah.
something?
Yeah, so I've been using Warp for I switched from iTerm, and it's been pretty effective. A while ago, AWS released Provider 6, and that broke a lot of our modules and components, similar or components. And similarly, Helm released was it version 3, and this was about the same time. And Warp was able to for every I just started typing it in here, and I switched to the mode where you start typing a request to the AI, and clone every repo in our org, then check out whatever the default branch is, then modify what is assumed to be the provider's TF. If there's a Helm provider, update it and pin it to not three. And same thing for AWS, which is assumed to have. And then open up a pull request. Here's the format for it. And it worked. It handled it all. And then, there were some minor
Do
tweaks we
you
had
use
to do,
Warp
but
for that?
yeah, I
Oh,
didn't.
that's cool.
Yeah, and I didn't have HCL Edit, which was, I know, another tool I could have used. Wanted to test out how's its native bash, and it worked great. And this is all on the free tier and stuff. And so, I mean, granted, I only used probably 10 requests for that, but it was able to work, which was pretty cool.
That is cool. Just a little bit more context there. So, we have our component organization, which has hundreds of repositories, and we need to bulk edit across all of those. So he was able to just dictate that to Warp to make that change across all those hundreds of repositories. It opened the PR, and then it created a script for him that he shared with another team member to go through and approve those pull requests and merge them. So that was kind of cool. The other interesting thing, and this ties into Amazon's like the other thing we talked about, all those MCPs that Amazon's coming out with. Well, there's another MCP we talked about a couple weeks ago at on Office Hours called by Context 7. And Context 7 has this MCP that has created LLM.txts for every major open source project out there, like Atmos, right? And so you can add this MCP to Warp, and then now it has the context of how to use basically every major open source command out there. So that's what you can do here by adding this MCP. And then when you're in your terminal here, you can ask, I haven't tried. We'll see if this works. How to run Atmos to list all of my stacks. Let's see what it does.
While that's running, the one thing that
And there you
I hope
go. So.
the one thing I need Warp to do, which it's apparently already a GitHub issue, and it's like a big technical rework, is it'd be great if it's embedded into VS Code or whatever your IDE is, because right now it is its own app, and so it's not when you go to the terminal at the bottom of your IDE or wherever it is located. It can't go there. It has to be its own separate app that you can switch to, and it's just I don't know. For some reason, it irks me having to actually switch Windows to go to my terminal.
Interesting. It's yeah, but I mean that would be the same. Like you couldn't run iTerm inside of VS Code, right?
Exactly.
But isn't that where those tools like Codex and Claude Code and Goose and the other like C agentic CLI tools kind of come into play? I feel like Warp is doing a great job of keeping it, again, I hate to use the walled garden term, but they're keeping it inside their own little thing. But these other
Fair.
tools like Codex and Claude Code and Goose and I guess Gemini CLI now, I can't forget about Google coming in. They all bring that functionality to the terminal, no matter what terminal you're using. It's still another UI, right? It's still another thing. You can't just start typing like you can in Warp and it just knows exactly the context and everything, but it's a little bit closer.
And I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I mean, while what Ben described could be done with Claude Code and possibly or arguably better, I still feel like there's a this bridges the gap yet between the terminal and Claude Code, if you will, any problems that you have in between. One question I though had, or so it doesn't sound like that many are using Warp terminal here. I was going to ask how you're using notebooks shared with a team, because I wanted to learn about that. So you can kind of have like a shared context for teams, so you're more effective on the command line. If nobody knows, then that's cool. All right. Any other things we can discuss?
Just because I think it just got brought up, having this Codex, Goose, Gemini, whatever that is, having these things in your CLI, it does kind of open up the window of, oh, it's headless, it no longer needs a UI. That means technically it's CI compatible. You could run it in GitHub Actions. And yeah, I mean, there is also edit mode. You can tell it to do a thing. And rather than having these static workflows, which we've grown used to for however many years of, you put in an input, it runs a scan, it runs a check, it does something static, and it gives you a relatively expected output. Now you don't know. Now it might, you could make it as simple as, hey, given the PR, add an appropriate PR label. So if it's touching a lot of functions, maybe it can add a high complexity PR label. That's something we couldn't do previously, perhaps. Now we could let some sort of
Run it down.
AI to look at the context, look at the PRs, look at previous PRs even, and then make a judgment call, add a PR, maybe even assign it to some specific people who have recently touched it. It opens up quite a few things, and since it's all in CI, it is viable, it's doable.
I would love, the biggest pain in the butt with like Dependabot and Renovate is very often updates do break stuff. And nobody's gonna, nobody, I mean, it's like nobody has time to go fix all of that. That would be perfect work to assign to agentic AI, or like a Copilot or something. Can you just, anytime this happens, open up a PR against that Renovate bot PR or Dependabot bot PR to fix the unplanned updates that we need to do so we can merge it? That would be beautiful.
And it's a thing I feel like I'm almost certain GitHub's going to do and get a lot better at this because they've already started injecting Copilot in a bunch of different pages. You can assign Copilot to an issue, it can create a PR based on the issue, you can tell it to look at a failed workflow log and suggest some workarounds. I'm sure they're going to do better at this. But with things like Codex, I guess you take that a bit further because now you get to control exactly what happens and when it gets to happen.
Well, so this is interesting to complete the story there. So I know Ben's been using it successfully a little bit more this past week. I got really frustrated with it because I couldn't get the environment to really for a complex code base for it to really be effective. It works in very simple code bases, but I could not, for example, I couldn't get it to work fully with Atmos and running in all the different scenarios we needed to do. And it keeps on hitting API rate limits with GitHub, but and that's just running like Go deps. I think it hits API rate limits on GitHub because it doesn't have a GitHub token.
This is Codex you're talking about?
This is in Codex, OpenAI's service. So, and this is using the web-based form. I didn't try it on the command line. I bet the command line will work better.
That's kind of surprising because you for Codex you have to sign into to GitHub because it ends up opening up a branch with commits from your
The
GitHub auth. So I'm
way.
surprised that it's hitting go downloads from limits from
Yeah. Well,
web.
and even the when it's running, it's not inside of a Git directory. Like, so Git commands fail. And that was the other thing. And maybe things have changed in the last 2 weeks or something, but that was the other thing that so if you have commands in your make file that are looking at Git, that would fail because it's like doing a tarball or like a zip download of the repo instead and branch instead of a checkout. And that was also annoying.
Yeah, I guess I haven't done any complex, too complex of operations with it. I've had it mostly work within a subfolder or simple app or something.
All right, cool. 10 more minutes. Anything else interesting to discuss today?
No, just based on those past little bits of conversation, I was thinking about the security aspect of it all. And I don't have a link to share right away, but I think there was some Claude MCP vulnerability that came up. But I guess like the more that I think, well, I was actually reflecting on it with a point.